This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. In this show, we talk about value, the social and moral value of business. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. This week, we're going to a difficult place. We're going to have a conversation about an idea that some people have a hard time wrapping their heads around. How do we as a society express, or dare I say, determine the value of a human life? The question itself forces us to make an important distinction between economic value and moral value. And to help us sort through this, I couldn't think of anyone better than the special master of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund, Ken Feinberg. Ken is arguably the world's leading expert mediator between the bank and the tragedy.
I only get involved in compensation and valuing lives when others, the President of the United States, the Attorney General, the Congress, a governor, a mayor, they come to me and say, will you do this? And I do it because I'd like to think that I'm giving something back to America and to my fellow citizens. I'm also, I think, trying to alleviate, if I can, at least one obvious stress point for victims: financial insecurity. If I can at least give victims one less thing to worry about by providing them some financial stability, I think I'm doing something good. But I always remember, always, that money is a very poor substitute for loss.
This year will mark a grim anniversary. 2021 will be the 20th anniversary of the most horrific act of terrorism on American soil. For many of us, that day isn't a distant memory. In fact, it's more like a movie that we play over and over in our mind as vividly as if it had happened yesterday. For me, I was on my way to work, driving over the Roosevelt Bridge into Washington, just as American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the West Wall at the Pentagon. I had a front row seat that day for the departure of 187 souls. When I reflect on that day, I'm convinced more and more it had something to do with my own soul-searching about the value of my life. And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, Ken Feinberg. Ken, welcome.
Glad to be here.
You're an attorney by profession. You've been around social justice issues for a long time. What drew you to this? Why do you think it was important?
I really think primarily what drew me was patriotism. Everybody in America was attempting to do whatever they could to help alleviate the horror and the tragedy surrounding 9/11. I thought that this would be a wonderful way for me to exhibit good citizenship and patriotism.
And charity. I mean, you did this work for no compensation.
Oh, that's right. Well, I didn't think it appropriate, frankly. If you're going to be a citizen stepping into the breach to assist the American people and the victims of such tragedy, you would be hard pressed to say, and I also want to receive compensation for my service. No, I thought that would be inappropriate. So for 33 months, I worked entirely pro bono.
Well, let's rewind the clock even further. I mean, we're going to have the 20th anniversary this year of September 11th, but your work goes much farther and deeper back than that. Tell our listeners about how you got started in the work of being a bridge between those who have suffered injury and surviving family and friends of just horrible tragedies and sometimes corporate malfeasance, just bad stuff. How you got involved in the justice process?
1984, April, that was the month. That's when Judge Jack Weinstein, federal district judge sitting in Brooklyn, he happened to be responsible. He was the judge in charge of the litigation involving Agent Orange and Vietnam veterans. You'll recall that the Vietnam veterans came home from Vietnam with various maladies, illnesses, and injuries allegedly caused by exposure to the herbicide, Agent Orange, the defoliant, that they became in contact with while serving in Vietnam. And there was a big lawsuit. I knew Judge Weinstein for many years. And he called me and he said, Ken, I want you to design and administer a settlement involving 250,000 Vietnam veterans and eight chemical companies like Dow and Monsanto that made Agent Orange and sold it to the Defense Department. And I want you to be the mediator, and I want you to be the claims administrator. And that was the beginning of a career that I never planned, that was never on my radar screen. But overnight, it changed my entire professional outlook. I went from being a Washington lawyer who had worked for Senator Kennedy, and suddenly I became a compensation expert who designed the programs, administered the programs as an alternative to litigation. And that was the beginning of my unanticipated career.
That's 250,000 veterans. That's an enormous class. Had anything like this ever been done before?
Not in torts, no. There's always been class actions, you know, in the consumer area, antitrust. This was the first effort by a very able and creative judge to corral all of these individual Vietnam veteran claims and turn them into a federal class action to be litigated in Brooklyn if the cases weren't resolved.
Now, a skeptic might say something like this maybe is designed to provide a buffer or a shield for these corporations. Do you see it that way, or do you see it differently?
I see it differently. Corporations usually oppose these class actions. They don't want all of the individuals to be combined into one lawsuit where they have all that leverage because of the sheer number of litigants. I think here, the chemical industry decided that the risks of being hit with a very substantial financial penalty were such that it was in their interest to settle the case. And that's why I mediated a successful settlement. It took us about 8 weeks, and we managed to resolve the litigation.
So what did you learn in that process?
I learned a great deal about how you get to yes, how important it is to be creative and competent and understanding of each side's positions, and how you try and, over time, fashion a settlement value to the litigation where both sides say, we're not happy, the settlement value of Feinberg is too much or too little, but it really does appear to be the best we can do, and therefore we'll do it.
Mm. Do you think that program made a difference in the lives of these veterans?
Oh, I think it did. I don't think the financial rewards made a difference. There were so many veterans and so little money. But I think the mere fact that the chemical industry and the United States courts, Judge Weinstein, validated their concern and their criticism about Agent Orange, yes, I think in that sense, there was some Vietnam veteran vindication from that lawsuit that they otherwise would not have received.
Okay, well, that's the mid-80s. So how do we get from the mid-80s to now 2001?
Well, once Agent Orange was resolved on the front page of all the newspapers around the country, I started getting all sorts of inquiries about mediating this case, this tragedy, this airplane crash, this asbestos injury, this DES anti-pregnancy drug injury. I mean, it became a mediation profession for me before there were professional mediators. And I began over the next 15 years to mediate and resolve all sorts of different controversies. The Shoreham nuclear plant had to be closed on Long Island. We mediated that. I was asked to arbitrate a dispute over the value of the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. What was that film, the original film, worth?
Yeah. Tell us that story. I don't know that our listeners may be familiar with that one.
The United States government seized the original black and white grainy millimeter film of Abraham Zapruder's filming of the Kennedy assassination in Dallas. And the United States government believed that that original film, the old grainy black and white film, was of great historical value. and should be protected and preserved in the National Archives in Washington. The only film of a horrible event in American history. Well, what was the film worth? It was owned by the Zapruder family in Maryland. And they said, well, if you want us to willingly surrender ownership of the film, we should be compensated. The government seized the film on grounds of eminent domain, that it had to be owned by the American people. So Congress set up an arbitration procedure. The government will choose one arbitrator. The Zapruder family will choose a second arbitrator. And the two arbitrators will choose a third arbitrator. They'll hear evidence, and they will determine for all time the financial value of that film. And we held a two-day arbitration in Washington. The federal government put on witnesses. The Zapruder family put on witnesses. And the three arbitrators reached a decision and valued the film at around $18 million paid to the Zapruder family. And the film to this day remains safe and sound in the National Archives in Washington.
How on earth did you come to that figure? I mean, we're going to talk in a minute about how to assess values as it relates to human tragedy. But something like this is different. How do you value something material that you know is it's priceless?
Well, that's right. That was the question. So the federal government called witnesses, and the witnesses said, you know, it's not a Da Vinci painting. It's not a painting by Michelangelo. It's not a Picasso. You can't show it in your living room. We compare it to something like a Babe Ruth baseball bat or the Don Larsen baseball that he used to pitch a perfect game in the World Series. We say $2 to $3 million, and that's a bargain. That is more than it's worth. It's only an old piece of celluloid. Well, the Zapruders brought in witnesses from Sotheby's and Christie's auction houses, and they said, this film, this historical artifact is priceless. If it were put up for sale, somebody with a lot of money, a sheikh, the Sultan of Bahrain, somebody would buy it and loan it or give it to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library or the Lyndon Johnson Library. This is worth a tremendous amount of money. This is worth like $30 to $35 million in the open auction market. And the arbitrators agreed on about $18
million. Mm-mm-mm. So in the archives it went, and you went about on to the next valuation, I suppose.
The next valuation, the next dispute. And then around, you know, in 2001, 9/11, and then in 2010, the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion, and Shoreham nuclear plant, and asbestos, and the Boston Marathon bombings on Patriots Day during the marathon a few years ago, the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, that terrorist attack that killed 58 people. All of these tragedies, Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, the 25 first graders who were murdered, all of these tragedies, the governor, or the mayor, or the senator, or the president, or the Congress have asked me to please make myself available to design and administer the programs, which I've done.
Oh, well, I tell you, I can't imagine how you go through daily life without having a mental health professional on speed dial. And there's a lot of hurt and angst in your world.
There is, and you never get over it. And unless you have a heart of stone, you can't help but be impacted by it personally. But you're given this assignment, you're asked to do something, you do it. And you feel some obligation to give back to the community. It's not fashionable to talk this way these days, but I...
Anywhere except on the show, of course.
That's right. But I mean, I grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts, when President Kennedy was in the White House. And I remember President Kennedy telling the American people that every single individual can make a difference. And I've tried to live that way in my professional career and tried to make a difference in advancing the communitarian ethic of the American people.
Well, let's go back. I live with this every day. I can still close my eyes. I can almost smell the inside of my car on that day on September 11th. The memories are so vivid for me. What were you doing September 11th, 2001?
I had just finished teaching a class in mass tort law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School in Philadelphia. And I left the class to head to the 30th Street Railroad Station to take the train back to Washington when I saw in the law school student union, the TV evidence of a plane hitting the World Trade Center. By the time I got to the train station, a second plane had hit, and the train got me as far as Wilmington, Delaware, on my return to Washington. When a third plane hit the Pentagon, all trains were shut down. I left the train with a couple of colleagues that I knew. We rented a taxi at the train station in Wilmington and drove home to Washington. I returned to Washington that day. I made sure that my son in New York City was safe. My daughter and other son were in Boston, and they were safe. And then I read in the New York Times that there was going to be a law established to set up a special victim compensation fund for the victims and their families of the 9/11 attacks. And I went to my old boss, Ted Kennedy, told Senator Kennedy of my interest in acting as the administrator of that program. And he called the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, who had been a senator from Missouri with Ted Kennedy. And I was interviewed by the Bush administration, and they asked me to come on board as a special employee to design and administer the program. And I did it for 33 months.
You've got this appointment by the president, and you're in consultation with the Attorney General, and your job is to set up this victims' compensation fund. So I understand that Congress was very moved to do something and to do something big, but they didn't give you many rules. And it was your job, I understand, to put all that together. So how did that work?
Well, you read the statute. What did Congress tell you about the confines of this special compensation program? What statutory directive is there? Then you put together a very small working group, lawyers that I know and trust, the Department of Justice, the Office of Management and Budget, and you sit around a table and you draft, based on the statute, the rules. You're right, Congress delegated to the special master.
I'm going to stop you here for just a second, only to ask you, because our listeners, by and large, are not legal scholars, explain what a special master is and what that role does and how it functions.
Special master is a legal term. He's like an administrator or a mediator, sort of a quasi-judicial officer who is delegated by Congress or a judge to perform certain tasks. And in this case, Congress mentioned in the statute the appointment by the Department of Justice of a special master, in effect an administrator, to design and administer claims arising out of the 9/11 attacks.
Okay, so you say design. So you were actually determining who was eligible to be compensated?
That's right. For example, it's all well and good to say that eligible victims are those who died on 9/11, either on the airplanes, at the Pentagon, or at the World Trade Center. That's relatively straightforward. Designing eligibility for death claims was easy, actually. Just, you know, present us a death certificate. But what do you do with all those physically injured? Now, the law said that physical injury claims are only compensable if the injury occurred in the immediate vicinity of the 9/11 attacks. Well, what is the definition of immediate vicinity in the World Trade Center? There were people filing claims. One lady filed a claim who lived on East 95th Street, 5 miles away, and she filed a claim saying that she was hanging a painting in her living room. When she saw the plane hit the World Trade Center from her window, she fell off the ladder and broke her leg. Is she eligible? Was she in the immediate vicinity of the World Trade Center? We said, no, you weren't. You're not eligible. We came up with a geographic boundary as to what was immediate vicinity. Then the law said, and if you're injured, you had to receive medical treatment within 24 hours. Well, we received a fair number of claims. First responders. Mr. Feinberg, I couldn't go to a hospital within 24 hours. I worked for 39 hours straight down at the World Trade Center trying to find bodies and excavate the damage. How dare you say 24? Well, we extended it by rule. We said it's 24 hours. Unless you're a first responder, then I think we gave you 72 hours. So there were statutory gaps in the meaning of the law that we had to and did fill using rules and regulations that we drafted in designing the program.
Okay, so you set up the guardrails, if you will. And from what I understand, there's much more to this because after it's been designed, you have to communicate it to the people who may be eligible. And I guess to be successful, you need to have a fair amount of participation.
Oh, that's absolutely right. The test as to whether or not the program is successful is how many people who are eligible actually applied. So you have to reach out, you have to publicize, you have to urge people to come into this program. And it wasn't easy. But in 33 months, 97% of all eligible families that lost a loved one on 9/11 voluntarily came into the program. Only 3% of the families, 94 people, decided voluntarily not to participate, to opt out and litigate against the airlines and the World Trade Center. And they all settled their cases within 5 years after the 9/11 attacks.
Okay, so the majority of people opted to participate in the program, probably for a number of different reasons, but I would suspect that it was the likelihood of getting funds quickly and size amount that would be justifiable for foregoing what I understand is the future ability to sue.
That's right. You had to incentivize people not to sue. I think that it was quite obvious when so many people, 97%, decided to come into the fund, they were of the belief that it was beneficial to them rather than litigate. And the people who litigated, that's fine. I had no problem with that. That was their right. I don't think that after paying lawyers' fees and costs, I don't think they received as much compensation as they might have in the fund, but entirely up to them. The biggest disappointment were not the people, the few people, the 3% who decided not to participate in the fund. My biggest disappointment were two people who did nothing. They never entered the fund. They never filed a lawsuit. Mm. They let the time expire and did nothing. One was a woman in her 80s who lost a son at the World Trade Center, paralyzed by grief. She never filed. And the other was a priest who lost a brother and who felt it was God's will, and he didn't file, and basically both of them surrendered in excess of $2 million tax-free each by not participating.
Okay, well, you mentioned money. What was the process by which you, I would suspect there was a track for people who were survivors and then those who were injured. But either tract of individuals, there had to have been a process by which you determined the value at which they would be compensated.
Well, you had to determine the value of a death claim as well. You had to determine a value in every single claim, whether it was a death claim being asserted by the family survivors or whether it was a victim, him or herself, who survived with injuries. And we did basically, we calculated value exactly the way that judges and juries do every day in every court in this country. What would the victim have earned over a work life but for the injury or the death? Add something for pain and suffering? There's the award. What you need is not a crystal ball. What you need is a good calculator. Yeah. That's what judges and juries do.
So, you know, sitting back away from the tragedy for a moment. Let's just put it on the table. I mean, a stockbroker who may have been on an upper floor who, you know, didn't have a chance of getting out, you know, is that the person whose compensation was the highest?
Oh, so a case like that, sure. Especially if the stockbroker at Cantor Fitzgerald on the top floors of the World Trade Center was making $1 million and died at the age of 32, that economic calculation is going to be very high, very substantial. Then you add pain and suffering. So you get an award through just a calculator, maybe of $25 or $30 million. Now, I never paid anything like that. I exercised my discretion, which I had under the statute, and reduced that award to single digits, $6 million, $7 million. But still, much higher than the average award of about $2 million.
Of course, that's how it works. I mean, if you were to discount the fact that this was a national tragedy and any other type of, you know, horrific incident, you know, the court system has a process of doing this. But just something I think intuitively hits people that, oh my gosh, you know, you look at $6-7 million for a stockbroker and a dishwasher who, you know, whose economic quote unquote value is a totally different profile. Is his life worth any less? And I guess it gets into that confusion about economic value versus moral and social value.
Yeah, of course you're right. Of course you're right. However, this is the American system. Forget the 9/11 fund, the stockbroker versus the dishwasher. Those varying degrees of compensation occur every single day in every court in the United States.
Yeah, we don't like to think about it, you know, just doesn't feel right.
Well, don't forget, in the 9/11 fund, every single claimant, the stockbroker's widow or the widower, or the banker's widower, or the dishwasher's widower, they had to voluntarily decide to come into the program. They didn't have to. As I say, 94 people decided to litigate. Secondly, if they came into the program and decided to take the funds, only then do they decide, I will sign a release and I won't go to court. Well, everybody had a choice, but everybody, I think virtually everybody realized the program was generous as it was, and that it would be more likely that they would receive generous compensation quicker than if they went to court.
Yeah. I mean, you really became the human face of this program. Tell our listeners a little bit about the outreach that you were doing and all of the visits you had with participants in the program.
It was not easy to get individual victims and their families to enter this program, not at first. This was a very unique program. Be careful, the devil you don't know. They had no idea how this program would work.
They meaning Congress.
I'm talking about victims who were reluctant to enter the program. I think Congress passed the law because Congress was worried that too many lawsuits would inhibit the government, the airlines. I think that the Congress was concerned about that. But still, convincing undocumented worker families that this program was on the up and up and that they wouldn't be deported, that they wouldn't be put in prison or fined, or their children wouldn't be taken away from them. It took some outreach effort by me to exhibit that type of assuredness that convinced people to come into the program. Mm. And they did. They did come into the program eventually.
You must be very persuasive. Tell our listeners about the visits you took abroad to talk about the program to foreign nationals who maybe were surprised about the, I don't know if generosity is the right word, of the fund.
They were surprised, they were skeptical, they were suspicious. I met with about 35 families from foreign countries in London, African companies, Asia, Norway, and I told them about the program. And I said, look, the average award here for a death claim is $2 million. You lost loved ones at the Pentagon or the World Trade Center, and you're eligible. Well, first, they suspected this was a CIA, some sort of CIA plot. Then they said, are you going to take away our passports? No. Do we have to come to the United States to get the money? No. How long will it take? A couple of months. Do we get the money in U.S. dollars or local currency? U.S. dollars. What's the catch? What's the catch? There's got to be no government is going to give away this type of money to foreigners. Well, when they saw that we were giving the money away and that it didn't matter whether you were an American citizen under the law, everybody was eligible. They all filed claims, but it took some time for them to be convinced that the program was on the up and up.
Well, I can imagine that there were a lot of heart-wrenching stories that you heard. I can't imagine. I remember reading in your book about a widow who was a cancer victim, and she was going through a tough time at the time of the attack. And then she finds your program, and what happens?
She came to me, 24 years old, sobbing. And she said, "Mr. Feinberg, I lost my husband at the World Trade Center. He was a fireman. And he left me with our two children, 6 and 4. Now you're going to give me $2.2 million. I want it in 30 days. I said to her, "Mrs. Jones, why do you need the money in 30 days? It may take a bit longer. This is federal taxpayer money. We've got to go to the Department of Treasury. They've got to do its due diligence." "No, 30 days. I said, "Why do you need the money in 30 days? She said, "Why? I'll tell you why, Mr. Feinberg. I have terminal cancer. I have 10 weeks to live. My husband was going to take care of our two children. Now my little ones are going to be orphans. I have got to find a custodian for the funds. I've got to find a guardian to take care of my children. I've got to set up a trust. I don't have a lot of time. And I need this money, and I need it fast." Well, we ran down to the Treasury, and we processed the claim in a very rushed, expeditious fashion, got her the money. 8 weeks later, she died. Now, I heard hundreds of stories like this, one more filled with pathos than another. And the stories vary as much as human nature: anger, frustration, sadness, disappointment, you name it.
Well, I mean, you said it. I mean, bad things happen to, well, you didn't use these words just yet, but bad things happen to good people. So what makes this Victims Compensation Fund any different than, you know, the people that were impacted by the Oklahoma City bombing at the federal building or any other number of tragedies that in this case may or may not have been connected to a government installation? I mean, what made this different, and why shouldn't everyone who is a victim of hurt and horribleness in the world be eligible to be compensated this way?
Well, it's really the other way around. In America, a program like the 9/11 Fund is a real aberration. You'll never see a 9/11 Fund again, I don't believe. It really is, as you point out, inconsistent with tragedy every day that results in innocent victims. The only reason I find convincing as to why the 9/11 Fund was created and was so generous is that the American people, acting through their elected representatives, decided, the 9/11 Fund, Congress decided we better do something for the victims. So I think the 9/11 Fund is just an example where the electorate ratified a program that it felt was commensurate with the nature and scope of the tragedy. And other tragedies, it isn't quite the same. All these other tragedies that I've worked on largely are privately funded by donor, by individual citizens, corporations around the country.
Sure.
Different.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, I understand you're working with some of the clergy abuse victims in New York, and you also worked with charities who, you know, come to the aid during these times of mass tragedy. And, you know, Americans are generous.
Never underestimate the generosity of the American people. It goes back to the Puritans in 17th century Massachusetts, the city on a hill. And I think the generosity of the American people is one of the extraordinary features of all these programs, to tell you the truth.
Well, Ken, before I let you leave the show, because I always ask all of our guests this question, in the work that you do, you think about it for a minute and reflect, you know, what does it profit? How do you think about what it is that you're doing and how maybe you might be an inspiration to others?
Well, first of all, I don't go looking for these programs. I only get involved in compensation and valuing lives when others, the President of the United States, the Attorney General, the Congress, a governor, a mayor, they come to me and say, "Will you do this?" And I do it because I'd like to think that I'm giving something back to America and to my fellow citizens. I'm also, I think, trying to alleviate, if I can, at least one obvious stress point for victims: financial insecurity. If I can at least give victims one less thing to worry about by providing them some financial stability, I think I'm doing something good. Mm. But I always remember, always, that money is a very poor substitute for loss. And when I take on one of these programs, do not expect thank you, gratitude, appreciation. It rarely comes, and don't expect it, because telling somebody I'm going to give you $2 million, but you'll never see your daughter again, that's hardly fair. It's hardly just. And I really don't use those words when you administer these programs.
Well, Ken, you have probably among the hardest jobs of anyone we're going to talk to on this season of What Does It Profit? So I'm thankful that you gave us an opportunity to take a glimpse into the world in which you work.
Pleased and honored, and good luck, and stay safe. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? And thanks to all of those of you who have gotten the word out about the show, especially our friends at CastBox. You can meet our team and sign up for our weekly newsletter at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. In our next episode, we're going to stay in Washington for a while with a new president and a whole new Congress. There's a lot to do. One of those big important projects is figuring out how to promote private investment that's needed to realize this exciting new agenda.
First of all, it profits our souls. The idea that you have a way that you can see how your investments affect the world, that the companies you invest in might treat their workers well, that you might be able to invest in companies that are building new buildings in your communities with union labor, with workers who are well paid and have safe jobs, that you can invest in a way that directly leads to the greening of the economy.
Next on What Does It Profit? Congressman Andy Levin, Vice Chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee, and one of those rising stars the Biden administration considered for Labor Secretary. Until next time, follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help us build the What Does It Profit community. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. Let us know your thoughts on the importance of exploring the moral and social value of business. Email a brief audio file to our production team at producer@whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com, and maybe your friends will hear your thoughts on the show. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was produced by guest producer Lucy Wang. Special thanks to our talented interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean, other team members, and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?